You're listening to a Sin podcast. You can listen to this show live by tuning your radio to 90.7 or online at sin.org.au.
We at Represent would like to acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land on which Sin operates, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sin Media respectfully acknowledges their ancestors and elders past, present and emerging. We would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our content reaches. Sovereignty has never been ceded, it always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Tonight, we are bringing you this special budget program from Ngunnawal land upon which Parliament stands.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're committed to.
Why do we want to fight it? When do we want it now?
I haven't flip-flopped. I said no originally, then I said yes, then I have said no, and I've stuck to it.
I didn't need to do this. I've already done a lot of wall for the election.
The English fought a civil war over this matter.
Don't deal with the nuance of the Canberra bubble.
I don't know what to do with it. We have so much money.
What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
Issues that perhaps may be controversial today, but 30 years from now, your children, your grandchildren are going to be thankful that you stood up for what was right.
Represent.
Represent.
Represent. You're listening to Represent.
Welcome to the 2024-25 Federal Budget Program on Sin.
So the gender-based violence package that's included in this budget brings the government's total contribution to $3.4 billion. So there's a whole host of focuses that are in this package, but as well as a lot that overlap with other portfolios. So particularly focused on gender-based violence, there's a counter-influencing program against online misogyny. There's a trial of age assurance to try and curb easy access to material that's known to cause harm. So that would be violent pornography and other things that are online that younger and younger people are becoming able to access. So there's also industry codes and standards being developed by the eSafety Commissioner. The government's planning to introduce legislation that's going to ban sexually explicit deepfake material, and that will be subject to serious criminal penalties. And they're also going to bring forward legislation that will criminalise doxing. So there's a few reforms that are going to help First Nations women and families escape violence. There's an additional funding of $44.1 million to support family violence prevention legal services, including Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services, as well as extending a First Nations family dispute resolution pilot for 2 years. There's also a lot of funding for housing that's included in the Housing Australia Future Fund. There's quite a bit of money for local healthcare, crisis and temporary accommodation, some of which will include an independent review of its effectiveness within that initiative itself. There's a $4 billion investment with the Northern Territory Government to halve overcrowding in the state, which will be $698.4 million over 4 years and $2 billion over 10 years from the federal government. So within universities, gender-based violence has been a major problem, and that's been addressed in quite a few reports. Notably, the government's introducing a national student ombudsman to investigate student complaints and escalate them. So the student can do that if they feel that it hasn't been appropriately dealt with by their higher education provider, so their uni, their TAFE. There's also $18.7 million to set a code for higher education providers to embed whole organisation approaches to gender-based violence and to strengthen accountability. There's also some changes to the carer payment, which obviously is in the women's package because the vast majority of carers are women. There's $18.6 million over 5 years and $3.1 million per year ongoing to support carer payment recipients. They're changing the 25 hours of work per week limit from March 25 to allow up to 100 hours of work per four-week period. So it's the same amount of hours, but it allows more flexibility for the recipients. There's also a lot of support for parenting. We've very much heard about the changes to the paid parental leave. And the addition of superannuation to that. There's also changes to aged care, which again has an 85% women workforce. There's $87 million to attract and retain aged care staff, and the government has committed to whatever increase to wages the Fair Work Commission recommends in their report, which has not yet been handed down. There's quite a lot for women's industry and women's careers in male-dominated industries. And notably, there's very severe differences in, or a gap, you could say, from First Nations women to other women. There were 17.7% lower workforce participation rates, and that significantly narrowed with higher levels of education. There's $777 million over 5 years for remote jobs and an economic development program, which will be in partnership with First Nations people. For women's health, there's funding for research into health priorities such as menopause, pregnancy loss, and infertility. Considering the amount of publicity they've had, I would consider $53 million not to be that much. There's also a few different things being added to the Medicare benefits schedule and the PBS, so medications and longer appointments, particularly with gynecologists. And some tariffs will be abolished on, well, some being 457, be abolished on menstrual cups and underwear. There's also $888 million for mental health, but we will talk about that more later. There's also major changes to the education portfolio. We discuss the changes to HECS that have already been announced with our interview with Karina Garland, which will air shortly. There's a lot of cost of living relief, including the placement payments and changes to student housing. This is a major change. So the government's announced that unis will now have to build their own international student accommodation if they take more students than is included in their allocation. So the allocation that unis get is decided by what accommodation they actually have available, as well as the size of the uni, the capacity to pay, and the current student profile. But this is going to have a major impact on unis because it will most likely mean that they'll either stop accepting international students or have to invest in additional housing. And we know unis aren't the best at spending on certain things. This also increases the perception that international students are responsible for the housing crisis that we're seeing at the moment, which is not the case. They only make up around 4-5% of the housing market, so, you know, a very small percentage. In addition, there is a lot of funding for fee-free bridging courses for $250 million to remove fees for courses to allow people to get into uni. This is projected to increase the numbers of people taking these courses by 40% by 2030. There's also a needs-based funding system that is targeted at one of the reforms that was recommended in the university's Accord report, which will target disadvantaged, low socioeconomic and First Nations students. They're going to establish the Australian Tertiary Education Commission as an independent steward for the university sector, and a medical school at Charles Darwin University. The National Student Ombudsman that you've heard about in the gender-based violence package, and an inquiry into anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and racism. They're also going to mandate that minimum 40% of the student services and amenities fee that every student has to pay annually is directed to student-led organisations, such as student unions, which will likely have quite a tangible impact. Turning to schools, there's funding for WA and the Northern Territory to fund all their public schools with the most disadvantaged funded first. There's funding stability for ACARA, the Curriculum Association, and some funding for closing the gap reforms, which is very important. That's receiving $75 million. Notably, there's nothing included for addressing the increased prevalence of radical, misogynistic and violent content that students are seeing. However, there is the age assurance trial, which is going to basically implement age verification. For early childhood education, we've heard a lot about the childcare subsidy. There's a significant amount of funding for that. There's $98 million to increase capacity to support the inclusion of children with disabilities in childcare environments. And there's $614 million to improve access in remote, regional, disadvantaged and First Nations communities to childcare, which is called the Community Childcare Fund, which helps 900 services nationally.
The portfolio on foreign affairs and trade has a focus on Australia's Pacific presence in this year's budget, including a $100 million investment over the next 3 years into Pacific disaster and climate relief. A further $50 million has also been allocated to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change Green Climate Fund, which targets developing nations in adapting climate change and disaster mitigation processes. We've got a lot of international support for climate change, especially rehabilitation, which I think we need a lot. And so we're seeing that distributed across our allied nations. So this $50 million will be distributed over the 26-27 and 27-28 financial years, so we're waiting a little bit for that one. But there's also $160.4 million allocated to Australian property expansion in the Pacific Islands, with an overall aim to enhance the Australian presence there. Back into Australia, from July 1st, Australians will be able to pay an extra $100 fee to have their passport application processed within 5 business days, which for procrastinators like me is a really good thing to have on hand. I also know people who have needed passports quickly, whether they're heading over for funerals, things that, you know, you can't just pop overseas for. So that's, I think, something I've heard people looking forward to as a speculative idea, but that'll begin. And the fee is estimated to increase the total receipt to around $27 million, which will be allocated to the foreign affairs and trade portfolio and reintegrated back into their spending. On travel, $29.9 million has been allocated over the next 4 years to simplify the trade system unit and create a digital trade accelerator, which aims to target biosecurity and border risk assessments within Australia. There is also a focus on Chinese trade and tourism, with $8.1 million over the next 4 years towards the approved destination status scheme, which will support tourists from China travelling exceptionally in guided groups in Australia. And there's also $2 million allocated to Australian agricultural exports to enhance our commercial trade connections with China. And finally, for foreign affairs, and this will move into the Defence Ministry, which Freddie's going to talk about. In the 23-24 budget last year, $4.5 million was allocated to support for Australian citizens, residents and their families inside affected regions of Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. However, it has been noted in the budget quite explicitly there's no further funding for these measures in this budget. That funding has already been allocated in the 23-24 budget.
So defence in the budget this year was surprisingly light on writing, but unsurprisingly very heavy on the spending. Most notably, $50.3 billion being allocated over 10 years to be put towards implementing the 2024 National Defence Strategy. This includes $1 billion to accelerate investment in long-range fires, fuel resilience, and robotic and autonomous systems, $11.1 billion to respond to the independent analysis of the Navy's surface combatant fleet, and $38.2 billion over 7 years from 2027 to support next-generation capabilities in the military. The writing on this program was quite extensive, despite the finer details lacking a little bit, but it's been described in the paper as a coordinated whole-of-budget, whole-of-nation approach to Australia's defence, spending across all domains, maritime, land, air, sea, space, cyber. It's truly an all-encompassing, almost overhaul to Australia's defence strategy, and the $50 billion price tag that comes with it certainly supports that. Picking up on what Naya said before with the overseas defence assistance, $144.3 million is being put towards assisting Ukraine. This was allocated last year and will continue, but hasn't been extended. This involves contributing to the international funds that provide defence systems for Ukraine's defence. No new investment has been made into the Israel-Hamas war. The $14.2 million in funding from the last financial year will conclude at the end of this financial year. My understanding is that further funding will be allocated if it is ever attended to, which I understand it is not at the forefront of the mind of the Defence Department at the moment. $14 million will also be allocated over 2 years towards a new grant program through the United Nations for peacebuilding and peacekeeping activities. So defence, light on words, but very heavy on spending.
Moving on to the health portfolio, there's a lot of winners in this section of the budget. So there's $3 billion for keeping medicines cheaper. There's a one-year freeze on the PBS co-payment indexation for everyone, up to 5 years for pensioners and concession card holders. And they're adding a lot of medications to the PBS. There's medications that are quite obscure for cancer patients, but there's also things like the COVID antivirals. There's also access to the Closing the Gap PBS co-payment programs for First Nations people, $142 million for vaccination programs and to address the declining rates of immunisation for First Nations people, $1.4 billion to the Medical Research Future Fund, and $18.8 million to the National One-Stop Shop for Clinical Trials and Research, which is basically going to be a centralised platform for people to access trials and research about healthcare and their conditions. So, in aged care, there's $1.4 billion to improve the digital aged care systems, which is something that's very necessary. $531 million for more home care packages to reduce the significant wait time that they have at the moment. $88 million to improve the workforce, as we heard in the gender-based violence section. And $37 million for the My Aged Care program. There's also $126 million to fund programs against communicable disease transmission with a focus on STIs, and to eliminate HIV, there's $43 million. There's also notably only $10 million for a roadmap for a skin cancer screening service, which Richard Scollier and Georgina Long, the Australians of the Year, are actually involved with and running. So there's also $71 million for cancer research specifically and $15 million for a skin cancer campaign. Obviously, Australia has some of the highest rates of skin cancer in the world. So moving to mental health, something that's been talked about and was expected in this budget was an addition to the 10 Medicare-funded sessions per year with a psychologist. However, that has not eventuated. There's $163 million for a digital mental health service that will be in operation, launching in 2026 and then ramping up until 2029 when it will be fully in operation. There's quite a lot of funding for this because it's something that's going to be free. You won't need a referral to access it. And there's $27 million for 61 Medicare-funded mental health centres. You can hear the bells ringing for the House of Representatives sitting right now. It doesn't seem like a whole lot of funding for free psychologists and psychiatrists that don't need a referral, but we'll have to just wait and see for that one. And there's also primary health networks for mental health nurses and social workers for people with complex needs to sort of form a wraparound service. So that will be really interesting to see that mental health situation play out, because obviously some of these services aren't going to launch for a few years, but the government has said that access to the 10 or at the time 20 Medicare funded scheme sessions was not coming from rural, regional or low socioeconomic background people, and additions to that scheme actually reduced while there were 10 extra sessions. So for whatever reason that was, they have decided not to change that scheme.
To energy and climate now, and there's energy bill relief incoming for all Australian households and small businesses. This is a $300 rebate for households and a $325 rebate for businesses. This will be delivered in the form of a credit to a customer's bill, applied evenly across all their bills throughout the next financial year. This will be delivered in collaboration with energy retailers and states. Over 10 million households will receive this rebate and 1 million small businesses. Obviously, with the rising costs of energy recently, it could be argued that $300 isn't necessarily the biggest improvement on easing the cost of living pressures. but I think having it spread across the year will definitely help. But for a lot of people, I don't think it's going to be what they were hoping for it to be. There's also a $47.7 million investment being made across 4 years into energy reforms. The government will investigate a potential one-click tool that allows households to get the energy deals that they are eligible for automatically. They're investigating a greater investment into the use of rooftop solar, household batteries, and electric vehicles, which could prevent customers paying $10 billion in network costs. Increased funding to the Australian Energy Regulator to help households switch to better energy plans through updated data and digital systems on the Energy Made Easy website. There will also be a statutory review into the Prohibited Energy Marketing Misconduct Act of 2019, which will ensure that customers are getting a fair go. There's an increased focus on renewable energy too, a $5.1 billion boost to renewables, including solar and battery manufacturing, as well as new industries like green metals and low-carbon liquid fuels. From 2027, there will be a $2 per kilogram tax incentive on hydrogen generation. There will also be a $2 billion investment into the Hydrogen Head Start program to incentivize people to start generating renewable hydrogen. $91 million to boost the workforce in renewable energies through training, apprenticeships, and facility upgrades across the sector. There's also money dedicated to international climate engagement. The budget paper reveals that Australia will bid to host COP21 with Pacific nations, and there'll be a continued engagement with Pacific regions on the energy transition. Funding to the regions on carbon sequestration will also be supported. $32.6 million will be provided to support the heavy industry in reducing emissions to meet the Paris Agreement targets by trapping carbon dioxide in storage facilities. There's also been $5 million provided to tourism operators this year to engage them in protection schemes for the Great Barrier Reef. Welcome to a special Represent interview direct from Canberra, where we're bringing you an interview with Dr. Karina Garland. Dr. Garland has been the Labor MP for Chisholm since 2022 and has been pushing for the changes to the HECS system we saw announced last week. We're talking to her all about that, as well as her thoughts on the upcoming budget and her memories of being one of the original members of Syn Media. We're talking to her now in her office in the Parliament House of Australia. All right, awesome. So, Karina, welcome to our first remote interview in Parliament House.
Oh, fantastic. This is so exciting to participate in your very first Parliament House interview.
Well, of course, we spoke to you over the phone last year, so it's really nice to actually be able to speak to you in person. We're talking about the HECS step changes today. So can you tell us a little bit about those? What's happening with that?
Right. So we're making changes so that about $3 billion of debt will be wiped for around 3 million students on a range of different student support loan programs, including HELP and VET loan programs. This is really around changing the way we calculate student debt and making sure that we're going to set the repayments at whatever is lowest, whether it's the wage price index or the consumer price index. So this is really good news for students right around the country who currently have debts, and the exact amount of money that they're going to get back can be calculated on the education.gov.au website with a very handy calculator.
Definitely. You've obviously been pushing very hard for this as well. What's the process been like getting it through?
I'm a new MP still. I was only elected in 2022. So this is a really exciting moment for me and my community to see what happens when we're able to work as a community in Chisholm and advocate for change is incredible. So we did a survey in my office for our electorate. We got hundreds of responses, and our survey was around what people wanted to see in terms of reforms in higher education, because Minister Jason Clare announced a higher education reform process, and something that came through really loudly and clearly from the electorate and from all kinds of people, whether they were students, whether they were parents, whether they were academics, was that people wanted to see a different way for us to calculate student debt, because it was seen as unfair that young people were having to take on huge amounts of debt, and that was starting to impact their ability to get loans and their ability to make decisions about their future. And something that was really troubling to me was we saw people really reconsider whether they should go to university or not based on the fact that they may be saddled with debt. And that's not what we want to see. We don't want people's ambitions for themselves and their futures to be limited by how much money they have. I've advocated quite hard with the minister, who was very receptive, I must say. He's been a terrific leader in this space. And written various opinion pieces. I remember I spoke to your team last year about this very issue and have been speaking to students on campus about this issue. And I was so thrilled to see the announcement just recently that we were making this change, which I think is the right thing to do.
Yeah, definitely. So another change that's happening is getting rid of the Job Ready Graduate Scheme implemented by the previous government. So tell us about the process for getting rid of that as well.
So a lot of the different changes that have come through in the pre-budget announcements and recommendations from the Accord were really things that were strongly felt by the community in Chisholm and I imagine communities right across the country. And to give a bit of additional context to the community that I represent, there are two universities in my electorate, Monash and Deakin, and you know, as a result, many students, many academics, but also people that really care deeply about education in the community. We have lots of teachers that live and work in our community. So ensuring that there is an equitable pathway to education is really vital for the people that I have the privilege to represent. So part of having an equitable system means having a fee structure that doesn't penalise students for making decisions around what, you know, their future. Like I say this as a former humanities student and someone who was a humanities academic too, that the devaluation of the humanities really, I think, is an indictment on the previous government. And I think it is a really good thing that we encourage people to be engaged, critically thinking citizens. And that's exactly what humanities degrees do. And to see attempts made to undermine the study of the humanities by the previous government was appalling, and that's exactly what the Job Ready Graduate Scheme was all about.
Totally. So you've kind of foreshadowed that there are more changes in the pipeline. There were obviously a lot more in the Accord that were recommended. Can you tell us anything that you might be pushing for with the minister?
We are doing that I have pushed for with the minister is paid placements for pracs. So at the moment there's something I think probably a lot of listeners will be aware of called placement poverty, where because students have to do unpaid placements in a range of different degree programs means that they can't work and that they're effectively been working for free. So we're introducing a scheme, and this comes out of the recommendations from the Accord process, for students studying nursing, teaching and social work. Those were the three areas identified by the expert panel of the Accord as the most urgent in need of support. $319.50 a week. Means tested for students undertaking pracs. This will mean people don't have to make a decision between continuing a degree or not based on their economic circumstances. These are really important areas of study and important areas of work. I think, you know, let's think about social work and think about the epidemic of gendered violence we've seen. We need more social workers. We need more people to work in the front lines, in domestic and family violence services. So this is going to have really far-reaching impacts across our communities. I think a number of changes that have already been made that perhaps have slipped under the radar were things I was advocating for with the minister, such as more protections for academic freedom. So we made changes recently to the Australian Research Council grant program administration so that ministers cannot intervene for political reasons and cancel funding for projects. I know people who had their funding cancelled for projects, largely in the humanities, by previous governments. It's appalling. And once, you know, a peer review panel has recommended a project get funded, we should respect the experts. And that's exactly what we're doing now. So, look, there's lots more to do in the research space. There's lots more to do around secure employment in academia. That is something I spoke about in my very first speech in Parliament. And I've been advocating hard for that. I hope that we're going to see a lot of measures around higher education reform in the upcoming budget and in budgets to come. There is a huge amount of work to do, and I don't expect it all to be done overnight, but I'll keep pushing hard for reform in higher education.
Definitely. And with the placement payments, obviously that covers quite a few of the most time-pressured placements that need, you know, extra funding. But is that step one? Is there going to be, because there's obviously quite a lot of degrees that were left out of that physio. We were talking about this on the show last week.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the other ones. But yeah, is that step one, or is this kind of the end of the placement payment scheme?
I don't think our government has an attitude that we're going to just limit our ambitions for the country. I don't think that's the case at all. I don't want to preempt what the future will hold and what decisions ministers will make. But I think every indication we've seen from the work we've been doing in higher education is that we know that reform in this space and a quality, sustainable system requires ongoing work. And that may mean making decisions around other programs to include in the future. I don't think we're closed-minded here. I think we're very open-minded about what the future of higher education looks like and have a very close relationship with the sector, with students, with academics, and we'll continue to look at what will deliver the best outcomes for students and for the nation.
Definitely. So there's a lot of really great changes that have been made. What do you think the tangible impact of those are for students?
Well, I think in the immediate term, it will be a sense of relief that debts will be wiped from that indexation that people had to pay last year. And I think a sense of relief too, that that's not going to be something that will be imposed in the future in the way it was. I mean, we shouldn't have a system where wages don't keep up with debt repayments in student loan programs. I think so that sense of relief, but also that the more money in the pocket for students will be part of this. And I think ensuring that people's decisions about what they do post-secondary school or through lifelong learning isn't limited by how much money they have in their bank account. Because something that the minister has been incredibly clear about and our government is really focused on is making sure that we have a system of higher education in this country that is accessible to everybody. We unfortunately have not seen the dial shift very much for people from low SES backgrounds and marginalised backgrounds complete degrees. We want to change that. We want more people to go to university, and we don't want it to be something, you know, that sort of pre-Whitlam era question of, can I afford it? We want anyone who has the marks and the ambition to be able to pursue what they want to pursue. And I also want to emphasise that the education reform that will help people get to university is not just about higher education. It's about what happens in the early years too, through early childhood education, through primary school, through high school, to make sure that people are on a really good education pathway that'll set them up for life.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And I think there's a lot of really interesting arguments around indexation at the moment because there are some alternative ideas coming around that. One of the ones from the University Accord was to change the date of indexation. So it comes after the compulsory repayments are made, after tax time. Do you think that's something we could be looking at? What would you think about that idea?
Well, I know the minister is looking at every recommendation really closely from the from the accord process. So I don't want to preempt any of his comments and thinking. But again, we went into this process with an open mind. We remain really open-minded around the recommendations. The people that are making these recommendations are both experts in their fields, but also people who consulted really widely and deeply on the key questions that the terms of reference sets out. So I think the minister is open-minded as to what we do. I don't want to, as I said, preempt any outcomes from his thinking and conversations around those recommendations. But I think the process was really good, and I think we've got a lot of really interesting ideas to contemplate.
And I think one of the more interesting ideas that I've seen from that was the Greens' idea to scrap indexation entirely. Do you think that's something we could realistically consider?
It didn't come up as a recommendation of the process, and I think we went through that consultation process for a reason. It's because we acknowledge that there are some, you know, pretty big opportunities and challenges in Australia's future, particularly in higher education, as a place where people can build skills that'll help build our nation's economic future, but also set people up for life in terms of being inquisitive citizens and contributors to their communities. And I think the process we went through was really considered. So I understand other political parties will have other views. I made a submission to the accord process, as everyone else was able to, and the experts took all the ideas on board and they've arrived at their recommendations, and that's the advice the government's taking.
Yeah. So there was a particular focus in the accord on low SES and particularly Indigenous students. Can you see the government going further with those reforms potentially than what was in the accord? And I mean, I know we were talking just before, you don't know what's in the budget either.
I do not.
I was going to say, oh, is there going to be more in the budget? But no point asking that because we're recording that beforehand.
Yeah. So we had an interim report for the accord where a number of recommendations were made that we acted on pretty quickly. So one of those was around student safety, and so we've now got a National Student Ombudsman, which is, I think, something that has been embraced really well by the community. And one of those other recommendations was to ensure that First Nations students were able to get a Commonwealth-supported place at a university, because there had been limitations on those places, and so we removed those limitations. So that is an enormous step forward in terms of access. I think that what will be the indication of how much work we have to do will be things like the Closing the Gap report that let us know how we're tracking, and looking at the numbers of completions from students from marginalised backgrounds. And obviously, if we're not seeing any positive movement in relation to completions, there's clearly more work we need to do. So I think that there is a really big job to be done in making sure that our universities are genuinely inclusive and that equity targets are reached and, you know, exceeded, I hope. But until that work is done, there will always be more for government, for universities, for communities to do.
Definitely. And I mean, we could keep talking about unis all day, but we are in Parliament House and we've been pretty excited to come up here. So I thought we would love to know what your favourite thing about working in this building is.
I love so much of it.
I think pick one.
I think
top five.
Yeah, we can have a list.
I think what is really great about working here is when you realise how thoughtful every detail in the building is. So from the colours that are used, the wood that is used, to really make this a very uniquely Australian building. The art collection is really incredible. So I have chosen artwork that reflects various things for me in my electorate. So I've got some artwork from Indigenous artists who are reflecting on Victorian art and colonialism, an artwork that was partly worked on through archival work at the State Library of Victoria. So it's a connection to Victoria and a connection as well to the arts in my electorate, because this was the place, my electorate in Box Hill, where McCubbin and Tom Roberts and a whole range of Australian Impressionists did their work. And so having, you know, some of the artwork in my office be a bit of a response to that is something that's I've reflected on in terms of my choices. And I think it's important really that Parliament plays a role in supporting contemporary artists in particular through inclusion in our collection, and that there is a focus too on artists who perhaps have been overlooked through history, so First Nations, migrant, women artists. We have a really great education program in Parliament, which is great. So I love seeing when school children come and visit. And so if people do watch Question Time on television, which, you know, I don't know if that's in everyone's idea of a great time, but you might often see politicians just start randomly looking up and waving. And it's because we've seen school students in some of the galleries and they're waving at us, and so we wave back. So that's really nice. I think the emphasis on this building being a place where anyone can come in and access is really, really important. And I know there have been challenges through COVID, through, you know, historically national security threats, but, you know, this building does belong to the Australian people. And so I think it's really important that people get to be able to access it and enjoy it. And it's a great way to hold people like me, politicians, to account by being here, by seeing what we do, not just during Question Time, but through other parliamentary debates too. So that's one of my favourite things, I think, the fact that it's such an open building.
I guess to touch on the environment on working within Parliament, What has the vibe been like over the past week or two with the budget looming, one of the biggest or the biggest political night of the year?
Well, look, I only arrived on Sunday night in Canberra because I only spend time here when we have sitting weeks, because I spend most of my time in my electorate attending community events and meeting with constituents. But there's always a bit of a buzz in the air. I think largely there's a, you know, the suspense is very palpable in the air in terms of people wanting to find out what's in the budget. And it's a very busy time because a lot of people who hope to see various policies funded in the budget all come up to Canberra for budget night. So I know that there are a number of early childhood educators, aged care workers, all here in Canberra right now in anticipation of hopefully getting a wage increase and some much needed cost of living relief. I don't know where we'll land. I'm hopeful that we'll have some really positive news for those workers. We'll wait and see.
And do you think those are the kind of things your constituents are looking for in the budget, or is there anything else you think they really would like to see?
Cost of living relief is very important to not just my community, I think communities across the country, not just in terms of individual households. I think people want to see governments behave in a way that emphasises fairness, and that we're doing what we can to address particularly, I think, intergenerational inequality that people have seen. I think the higher education reforms that we've gone through quite a bit are going to be very well received. And I think any targeted cost of living relief will be very well received too. I think they're the things that people are looking to the most in terms of the budget. And there'll, of course, be all sorts of programs for funding for various initiatives that people will be able to apply for in the future that I think people are looking to as well to make sure that there'll be funding.
And, of course, we can't neglect to mention that you were also a sinner.
Yes.
In your uni days.
I was.
Do you have a favourite memory from your time at SIN?
Oh, goodness. I think my favourite memories really are just about the people that I met while I was there. So some of them are still my closest friends now. And that's a really – it's, you know, it's a really nice experience to have had and to – have you know worked on news bulletins with people who ended up then being my housemates, and then I was bridesmaids at their wedding. You know, that whole journey that started off with SIN is, I think, my favorite memory. That, you know, we met as optimistic, wide-eyed young people, and, you know, life, despite, you know, pulling us all in different directions, you know, we still managed to kind of remain friends and share in each other's experiences over the last many, many years.
That's promising for us, considering we thought this trip would ruin us as a three.
No, well, it's a great test, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I survived share houses with SIN friends. You'll survive this.
Yeah, but that's what, 7 hours in a car together? Only one way to find out.
We made it through the first one.
Yeah, but there's a whole other one to go. Anyway, I think we can probably leave it there. EP, yes?
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to a SIN Media podcast, where young people run the show.